Our next speaker is Dr. Ed Rossi with the Environmental Protection Agency. We claim that Annie's our soil mole within EPA.
All right, thank you, Bruce. So as we said, I'm at EPA and I'm working on the National Wetlands Condition Assessment. So today I'm going to talk a little bit about the NWCA and how we're starting to look at some of the soil data that was collected and see if we could possibly use that to evaluate wetland condition and potential stressors in wetlands. So what is the NWCA? It's a national probability-based survey of wetlands across the conterminous U.S. It's a part of the EPA's National Aquatic Resource Survey Program, and this is basically a joint effort by EPA, states, tribes, and federal partners to evaluate and assess the condition of our nation's waters. So it actually involves four different surveys looking at lakes, rivers and streams, coastal waters, and wetlands. And each of the surveys is run on a five-year cycle. So the first NWCA was done in 2011, and we just released the final report of the results earlier this year. And then the second survey was done this summer. Crews just finished sampling in October. So the overall goal of NWCA is to evaluate the condition of wetlands and obtain more information about how we might be able to better protect and restore these resources. It also complements the Fish and Wildlife Status and Trends Program. They report on wetland acreage. So with these two surveys together, we can talk about the quantity of wetlands in terms of area and then quality as you know, ecological health. Our target population for the survey includes tidal and non-tidal wetlands in the conterminous U.S. that meet the cordon definition. This is the same definition used by the Fish and Wildlife Service as part of the NWI maps. The cordon definition is an ecological definition, so wetlands have to meet one of the three criteria, so either having hydrophytic vegetation, hydric soils, or wetland hydrology. We use the same sample frame for selecting sites as the status and trends program, so all of these sites were randomly selected using a probability-based survey design, and that allows us to report on the population as a percentage, so we can say 48% of wetland area is in good condition nationally and make other sorts of estimates. You will notice the distribution of wetlands, it is based on the aerial extent, so regions in the country such as the Gulf Coast, the Atlantic coast, where we have more wetland area, we have more points, more sample sites in those areas. I just want to touch briefly on our field sampling methods. All the sites were sampled by a field crew of about 4 to 5 people and had to be, generally were completed in one day. So when we thought about the types of data we were collecting and the methods, we had to be logistically feasible for a crew to accomplish this. So at each sample point, we had a core assessment area, and that's represented by the red circle there. It's an 80-meter diameter circle, and within that assessment area, crews collected data on vegetation, soil, water chemistry, algae, and hydrology. There were 4 soil pits that were each described to a depth of 60 centimeters, and then crews selected 1 representative pit that they then described and sampled to 125 centimeters. Those soils were sampled by Horizon, and then all the soil samples were analyzed by the NRCS Kellogg Soil Survey Lab. Then crews sampled from the surrounding buffer area, and that's represented by the blue circle. And that circle extends 100 meters from our assessment area. There were 12 buffer plots, and in those plots, crews collected data on natural cover, evidence of anthropogenic disturbance, and then targeted invasive plant species. So each of the sites for the survey were screened and placed along a disturbance gradient from the least to most disturbed sites within wetlands of the same type and in the same ecoregion. So to assign them on this disturbance gradient, we basically used the crew's observations of disturbance within the assessment area and buffer, concentrations of heavy metals in the top 10 centimeters of the soil, and then the presence of non-native plant species in the assessment area. So when I talk later in this talk about the least and most disturbed, that's how we got those rankings. Oops. So most of the reporting for NWCA 2011, the condition assessment part of the report, is really based on the vegetation data. So All the sites were assessed to be in good, fair, or poor biological condition based on the vegetation communities. And then when we were looking at stress, it was based primarily on evidence of hydrologic or vegetation alterations at the sites. But we collected all this soil data, and we really wanted to look if the soils might be useful indicators to either tell us about condition or potential stressors. Soils are often reflective of the area surrounding them, so they might show us stressors that are happening somewhere else in the watershed that we maybe don't see directly in the assessment area, but still impacting that wetland. They can also, soils tend to be stable, more stable over a longer period of time than some vegetation. So a disturbance that maybe happened 10 years ago that's still impacting the site, but crews couldn't directly see, we might be able to get that through the soil. So I've just initially started looking at carbon, nitrogen, and phosphorus ratios in the top 10 centimeters of the soil. So that's what I'm going to kind of focus on for the rest of my talk. So just to give you an idea of the range of data or the range of carbon, nitrogen, phosphorus we saw in these soils, I've got a table there that shows total carbon, total nitrogen, and total phosphorus. This graph just shows the distribution. Carbon, this is total nitrogen, and you can see both of these, we have a positive skew to the data. And this is particularly true in the total phosphorus. I've actually graphed that on a log scale, just so you could see the full range. There is a particularly, that maximum value of 50,000 milligrams of phosphorus per kilogram is incredibly high, so I actually kind of questioned that data point when I first saw it. But the site is located in an old phosphate mine. So I think that's what's happening there. When we look at the carbon and nitrogen to phosphorus ratios in the top 10 centimeters, so that first column are the average values we measured in NWCA. The range in parentheses represents the 95% confidence interval around the mean. And then I've also included two other meta-analysis papers that looked at carbon-nitrogen phosphorus ratios in soils. The first one by Cleveland and Lipton, these average values they reported on soils globally. And then the second paper, they looked at soils across the world, but they looked at different ecosystem types. So I just showed the values that they reported for natural wetlands. And you can see the numbers for NWCA sort of fall in between these two. But they tended to have, we saw a much bigger range in the values for NWCA than in these two papers reported. So first, I kind of wanted to look at what other soil properties might be affecting these ratios and start thinking about if we could really look at these numbers nationally or if we needed to group the soils. So these graphs show the carbon to nitrogen ratio, carbon to phosphorus ratio, and the nitrogen to phosphorus ratio all plotted against total carbon. And you can see there's a positive correlation for all three of these. Basically, as our carbon contents increase, we see higher nutrient ratios, which would suggest some nitrogen and phosphorus limitations in our higher carbon sites. So I just want to kind of back up a bit and talk about how we reported our data for the NWCA 2011. In order to have to make comparisons among wetlands, we needed to group them somehow, but we couldn't split up every ecoregion or every wetland type because then we just wouldn't have enough sites to make statistically valid reporting. So the Amerenik Level 3 ecoregions were grouped into four main ecoregions, and then the cordon wetland types were grouped into four main wetland types. And the decision on which wetland types to aggregate and which ecoregions to aggregate was based primarily on the vegetation communities within each of these groups. And while that worked for the vegetation indices we used, I'm not sure it's working as well when we start looking at the soil. I didn't find any correlations between the nutrient ratios and latitude, longitude, precipitation, or temperature at the sites. And I think this is just because when we think those sort of get at measures of the climate, but they may not really assess the soil climate as well. When you think about something like precipitation in an upland area, that really gets at water availability and things like carbon accumulation. But in the wetland, precipitation may not be your main source of water and may not really indicate how wet or dry the site is. So you may not get an idea of how much carbon is really accumulating there. So just to start, I chose to just break the wetlands up into two wetland types. So the estuarine wetlands, those are on the side closest to me, on my right. Inland wetlands, that includes the palustrine, riverine, and lacustrine wetland types on the left. And this graph shows total carbon on the x-axis and the carbon and nitrogen ratio on the y-axis. The blue dots represent the least disturbed sites, and the red dots are the most disturbed sites. And so you can see that they both follow the same trend. As we have more carbon, we have a higher carbon and nitrogen ratio. But we don't see much difference between the most and least disturbed sites. And this isn't totally surprising. I think this might be because the carbon and nitrogen cycles are pretty closely linked in soils. So as carbon accumulation might be affected by a disturbance, the nitrogen accumulation is similarly affected, and the ratio remains relatively balanced. When we go to the carbon to phosphorus ratio, there is actually a difference between the least and most disturbed sites. They follow pretty similar trend. The slopes of the blue lines and the red lines are similar, but there is a difference basically between the intercepts of these lines. So we get a statistically significant difference between the carbon to phosphorus ratios in the least and most disturbed sites. But even though this difference is statistically significant, I'm not sure that we're getting a meaningful difference here. There's a lot of variability, a lot of overlap between least and most disturbed, and it would be really difficult to identify a carbon to phosphorus ratio that you could use as a threshold to say below this point, I think the site is disturbed and has an increase in phosphorus. Similarly, we see differences between the nitrogen to phosphorus ratios in the inland sites with, again, a slightly lower N2P ratio in the more disturbed sites, so they have a relatively, maybe showing an increase in the amount of phosphorus relative to nitrogen. But again, the meaningfulness of this relationship is a little bit unclear at this point. The difference between the least and most disturbed sites at the estuarine wetlands was not significant. So at this point, we really have a lot more questions than we have answers. There's a lot of variability among the sites, and we don't know if the variability maybe is masking some of these weak relations that we're seeing. Maybe they're masked by other covariables that might be affecting their nutrient ratios, or if there really is no clear relationship between the carbon-nitrogen-phosphorus ratios and disturbance. So kind of my next steps are going to be looking at more of the soil properties and site conditions and how we might be able to group some of these sites that could constrain that variability, and we could get at some of these questions a little bit more clearly. One thing I think is going to be really important is hydrology, particularly how frequently and the duration of saturation at some of the sites, as well as some properties, maybe forms of phosphorus or other soil nutrients that might be in the soils. If anyone is interested in reading more about NWCA or accessing the report, it's available online, as well as all the data collected in 2011 and data from all the other surveys. And then just also I want to make a plug to any graduate students who are interested in using the data. We are currently offering a campus research challenge, which is basically prize money for graduate students using the data. So if you're interested in that, please get a hold of me and I can tell you more. And then, obviously, this is a huge research effort and takes a lot of coordination between a lot of different agencies. So really thank everyone who's involved and all the field crews, and then particularly NRCS for their assistance with the lab work. And Lenore Vassilis played a huge role in coordinating between EPA and NRCS. And with that, I'd be happy to take any questions. Right.
But you got the same CP, but one could be impacted by mineral winter washing. So I think you're right. I think you're going to have to somehow look at what form you have.
Yeah, and one thing, and I didn't include it in this because I haven't wrapped my head around it enough, is one of our state partners in Wisconsin, they actually found using the oxalate extractable phosphorus as a ratio with total phosphorus, really showed some very clear separation between the least and most disturbed, and kind of thought of the oxalate phosphorus as sort of the redox available phosphorus, because that's what's bound to the iron and aluminum. And actually, when I just kind of plotted it with some of our data in estuarine wetlands, we do see that same sort of thing, but in the inland wetlands, we're not quite seeing the same trend, but they saw it in Wisconsin, and they don't have estuarine wetlands there, so I think we still need to think about how we're going to group some of these sites, but it is something that shows some potential. Yeah.
So it seems like, so this is a pretty impressive data set, but it seems like most of the questions that you're trying to answer would be better answered if you had repeated measures. So are you planning on going back to these sites in like 10 years, 20 years down the line?
So the sampling will be done every 5 years, but the plan is to resample 25% of the sites from the previous survey. So this year we did the 2016 survey, and it ended up being about 20% of the sites were repeated, and that will allow us to make trend analyses going forward. And every 5 years they'll bring in some new sites, but also have some repeated sites.
We're going to have a discussion period after this. We can have further questions, so let's try to stay on schedule. Thank you, Amy.